The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now it's True Wealth, presented by Little John Financial Services. Here is David Littlejohn with True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it's that time of the week. It's the best Tuesday I've had all week, and we are stoked to bring to you the True Wealth Radio Show. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn. Joining me in studio,
Matt Dixon.
All right, Matt.
Okay.
What's on your mind?
Well, I know that the 30-year mortgage was up to like 6.875% the last
time I checked. Wait a second. This is the same 30-year mortgage that at the end of 2022 was like 4.25% or something?
Yeah.
So that's like a 50% increase in the cost of a mortgage.
It's insane.
All right. So we just shut the program down right now and just say it's all going to collapse, right?
Well,
it's over.
I think a lot of people might say that, but I don't know that we should jump the gun, should we?
I mean, we've
been higher than that before, right?
Oh, well, yeah, we have. I mean, I remember back around 05, got a mortgage when I moved to town and purchased my first home in Douglas County,
mm-hmm.
and thought 6% was pretty solid.
Okay.
And my folks were like, yeah, I mean, shoot, 8% looked pretty good a couple of years ago. You got 6? And then it proceeded to drop below 3 at one point. And, you know, the bottom falls out of the market. We were structurally trapped and couldn't refinance or anything. And I remember then being bitter about 6% being so high.
Yeah.
And here we are back to over 6%. Oh, my goodness.
We were spoiled there for a while, right? Like,
we were
seeing a lot of, like, you know, in the mid twos on a few mortgages there for a little bit, and then it went up into the threes, mm-hmm. and everyone was still happy. And then all of a sudden, boom, almost overnight.
Yeah. We have been really, really spoiled for a really long time, considering that 2005, the mortgage rate. So mortgage rates went down after 2008, and they stayed down. So that's been almost 14 years
mm-hmm.
of
really cheap
super
money.
Super cheap money.
Yeah.
And now it is like Pandora's box has been opened. The rates are on the rise.
I looked up a statistic for our listeners before the show started.
And okay.
And this is just kind of crazy to think about. But on a 30-year loan, if you loan out at 4.65%, that ends up being 60% of the money over the course of the loan goes towards interest payments.
Wow.
Yeah, so over half your money on a 30-year loan, 4.65% is going just towards interest.
Right.
And so now we're looking, you know, at 6.8, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's a number of dynamics at play in housing. My sense is that we have to look at two different variables at the same time, though.
Okay.
Right? So the first one is, the cost of the mortgage now is like, well, how much can you borrow? But then we also have to look at the idea of wage inflation. And are we seeing wages rise?
Is it keeping pace with that change?
My sense is probably not, right? Because if you just do the math straight across the board, a 50% increase in interest cost doesn't mean a 50% increase in mortgage payment. So here's
what
I mean,
right?
Going from 4% to 6% on your mortgage doesn't mean your payment went from $1,000 a month to $1,500 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's not how that translates. But it does mean the cost of capital is higher. So your $1,000 a month mortgage may have gone up to $1,300 a month
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And that is a material shift,
right?
So then you look at it and say, well, did you get a pay raise that was enough to keep doing that? But there's more to it than even that, isn't there?
Ooh, wow. We're really starting to unravel things. Okay.
Well, if you consider that you're competing. So let's think about, all of us have to think this way as a consumer, right?
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff out there in the world, we have two major things or two major categories competing for your wallet. Okay. Needs
and my
wants.
Wife. Oh.
All right. I hope that she didn't hear that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Needs are the ones that you don't really get a choice. right? It's needs compete for your wallet. And what you do with needs is you try to manage them, and sometimes you substitute. Like, you need mm-hmm. food.
Right.
But maybe you're substituting for a lesser cost or quality in some cases of food. And you hope it's not a quality sacrifice. But you can, I mean, this is the old expression of, like, if you can't afford steak, then you're getting ground beef. And if you can't do ground beef, maybe you're going to chicken. If you can't go to chicken, you're going to rice and beans.
It gets much worse, though. People are going to start pulling smallmouth bass out of the Umpqua and start eating on cheap fish.
You know, maybe that is part of the scheme. Like, we just need to get rid of the invasive species, so just go catch them.
There you go.
And there's a snack. You know, the real trick is, can you make them tasty? I don't know.
People claim that they can, but I haven't been willing to try it yet.
Yeah, Matt, by the way, if those of you listening don't know this, here's an interesting piece of trivia about Matt. I think he'd rather be fishing than almost anything else. I think, you know, sleep and food compete with it, mm-hmm. but he's willing to give up the sleep for the fishing.
It's true, but I don't like to eat the fish that I catch.
That's the weird part, right? It's like, loves to go fishing, loves to catch the fish, doesn't do anything with the fish other than give it away if it's mm-hmm. a fish that other people will eat, or put the fish back in the water and be like, great, let's see if I can catch you again, fish.
We've done that before. This year we did. We managed to catch the same fish like 2 days later.
At which point you're like, come on, dude, you didn't learn the first time?
Right.
So anyway, the water's clearly cloudy and murky down there. Yep. So anyhow, that's the little side note about Matt. But Matt, nevertheless, wants needs, right? Okay. So the needs, we got to eat. We have the basics. The bottom of the pyramid of Maslow's hierarchy.
Ooh.
We heard that term before, everybody, right? It's a psychologist that said, hey, you know, here's the way you start with, you need like food and shelter, like basic personal security before you can move into like the next level of more self-fulfillment, and then you get into wants, needs, self-actualization, and so mm-hmm. forth. So the bottom of the pyramid. But you know what? First of all, if you run out of money before you've secured the bottom of the pyramid, life is very hard. Right? I mean, it's very hard. And here's, I will tell you that I'm not without compassion when I say this, because the world is getting complicated to navigate. Right? Because we've created so many tools that will do jobs that people used to do mm-hmm. that were the entry-level jobs. Right. You talk about, you know, there used to be the joke like, well, you can hire anybody to flip hamburgers. You don't have to. The robot can do it. Right.
I mean,
you don't need a hamburger flipper anymore. You have other things that can do that. Mm-hmm. They have technology that's now figured out, like burger on a conveyor belt that cooks for a certain amount of time, flips it over, cooks the other side, and off the other end it rolls to make a sandwich.
When you go to the store and you're checking out and you have the option to go to a cashier and have them check your stuff out or do the self-checkout, which direction do you typically hit?
Depends on how much I have.
Oh, okay.
Right? If there's a few items, I go wherever it's fastest.
Okay. Because but if you have a ton of items, you don't want to do it yourself?
Oftentimes it's because if you have a ton of items, mm-hmm. they're set up to manage a ton of items better.
Yeah.
Try to take a ton of items and go into an area where you've got something the size of a notebook to try to pack all your groceries into.
Yep.
It doesn't really work.
Okay.
Right? So I'd rather just say, well, I'm scanning these across. We're going to put them in bags on your little carousel. And when we're done, I'll load them up and get out of there.
Yeah.
So it is a volume consideration as well as a time consideration. I don't look at it the way some, I mean, I know there's some people out there that say, well, you know what? I'm not going to, you know, I'm not getting paid to bag my own groceries. Somebody's there for that. So I'm, you know, that's what they should do.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the flip side of it, which is, I don't want anybody else touching my stuff. So I'm, you know, it's wrapped.
You don't take a necessarily hard line in either direction.
No, what you're going to discover is I rarely take a hard line on any of these things, because there are different reasons that these things appeal or don't appeal. Mm-hmm. And like, to the person that is insistent, like, it's not my job to bag the groceries, I look at that and go, yeah, but what if your groceries were 2% cheaper? Is it your job now?
Hmm. Yeah, that's
right.
And because
the person drawing that hard line is like, do you really have any idea what the operational expenses underneath the hood of that business are? I mean, people have no idea what what kind of margins Walmart has.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're just like, well, super mega corporate, and there's people that are super rich because of Walmart, so they suck. And I'm like, hold the phone for a second. I mean, Walmart's a company that went public, and the people that originally started Walmart had shares in that, and so they have ownership in a company that's now got gigantic footprint all over the globe and does mass retail. So tons of money moves through Walmart, and a little piece of a ton of stuff ends up being a lot. But how much margin on that macaroni and cheese do they make?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it 5 cents? And you're like, right. Well, for that 5 cents, I should get spoiled. And I'm like, guess what? If somebody told you to spoil them for 5 cents, you tell them to pound sand.
Yep.
So there's a lot of people with a double standard, because it's like, well, I'm just hiding behind my lack of knowledge about how it operates. You know, and so I have this sort of, you know, high and mighty position, if you will. I'm like, well, we don't know what we don't know.
That's fair. That's fair.
Anyway, how do you get me off on the rails on
that? You know, I'm pretty good at that. I'm pretty good at that. That's what I'm here for, to just put us in the weeds.
It's so ridiculous. It's not like I'm shy in opinion on these things, but I'm just less hardline than I used to be.
I'm going to do better. Let's get back into what we were talking about. So we were talking about how interest rates are on the rise and mortgages are more expensive.
And now if your wallet hasn't grown, right? It's a way of saying if you're not getting paid more, but essentials in your life cost more, you have to start making substitution decisions. That's a squeeze on the consumer, right?
Mm-hmm.
The loss of purchasing power because inflation is outpacing your paycheck growth. That's a dangerous spot for the consumer to be in.
Well, and business profits too. Business profits are changing as well.
Business profits are definitely changing. But, you know, that's one of those where, again, I don't have full transparency on what the profits are. How many companies are raising prices because their input costs are going up and they have to survive, versus they're opportunistic because they're saying, well, you know, with inflation everywhere, we can get away with this and improve our margins.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that, but my suspicion is both are occurring.
Ooh.
Right? Yeah. I just don't know where. And it'll take a little while for that to shake out before the data catches up to be able to tell us.
Right. And well, in certain sectors can price adjust more rapidly than others, and that plays a huge effect as well.
And even like, how does one compartmentalize businesses that have different units? Like if you look at big pharma and you go, my gosh, how can you charge $40,000 a month for this cancer drug?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And especially when you're making, you know, billions of dollars. And so you're just gouging people that are desperate. And I'm not going to lie when I say it sure seems that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then the company will turn around and go, do you have any idea how many millions of dollars we had to spend to develop this drug, to do what it does, to go through the FDA process and deal with all the different layers of bureaucracy to get it to market in the first place? We are so deep in the hole on this thing. We've got to recover money somehow.
Yeah, and can you imagine the liability insurance those companies have to carry?
Well, that's a separate issue, right? Yeah. Because once it clears the FDA, my understanding is there's different rules about liability associated there. But nevertheless, if you consider like, hey, if a company spends $250 million to develop a drug that is only going to be given to 10,000 total people, what's the cost per person? I mean, is that $25,000 per person to recover that sunk cost? And if you're saying, yeah, but they make a ton of money on the drugs that they've had forever that, you know, they're selling heart meds or something to everybody and they're making $5 on everybody. So they're making like $2 billion over there. Okay, you're right. But what company motivated by profit says, well, yeah, I'm willing to make this other thing an altruistic loss leader and cannibalize my profits on the one that's making me money?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And now you're like, well, Where do you draw the line of, well, how would you incentivize a company to even develop a drug that they can't profitably make?
Yeah.
So then the person that is getting a $20,000 or $40,000 cancer treatment is like, or it's just not there at all. And I'm like, it's not cut and dry. I think that's the issue.
It's true.
So anyway, yeah, thanks for another journey into the weeds, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got to take a break. So we'll do that.
I'll run home. I'll get the weed whacker. We'll come back.
We'll do that. And when we come back, we'll talk about other fun stuff. But we'll do this first. So stick around. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Yeah, I mean, like at some point we're going to do a program on like the whole NFT crypto space and how. All right, anyway, so we're back. So, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
All right, and we did mention that'll come back later. I am on a study quest around crypto. And like I've gone from, hey, this is novel to understanding use cases, understanding abuse cases more so, right? And so I'm going through that learning curve of use and abuse, how it functions, what it does. And it has really made things interesting all of a sudden to me, looking at the potential pathways into the future and how these, what the use cases for this technology might be.
Yeah.
So, and why is this relevant to you as a listener? Because, you know, we were just talking about interest rates, and I guess I could make a really hard pivot and say it's really interesting to see that the world as we've known it for like the last 15 years is likely to be changing. Right.
Yeah.
And I think values and valuations are shifting a lot right now, or can potentially shift a lot. So,
can you give me an example, kind of what you're talking about?
Well, real estate's the first one.
Okay,
right. I mean, if you think about higher rates, what's that do to real estate? Changes people's ability to borrow.
Right.
Right. And so, it changes the amount of money available to chase this asset.
Mm-hmm.
But now let's think about. So, all of you out there investing right now, here's this silly question. Would you rather loan somebody money for low interest or high interest?
Man, I hope everyone said high interest.
Yeah. I mean, if it's not an like what we will call an altruistic loan, like if you're not doing this because you're just, this is like when your parents and you say like, you know, I really want to help my kid buy a house. And so I'm just going to like give them a really favorable deal that doesn't work well for you, but you're just taking care of your kid, right? It's a sweetheart deal. Well, okay. But that doesn't count as investing. That counts as you helping somebody else out. You're investing in like making your heart feel full, but not your wallet.
That's right.
Okay. But if you're seeking profit, then you go, well, no, I want the best interest rate I can get. And if you're borrowing money, you want the opposite, right? Hey, I want to pay as little as possible. Okay. Enter the bond market.
Ooh.
Okay.
We haven't talked about bonds in a long time.
We really haven't, and it's super relevant. For everybody listening, I'm just going to give you brief insight into our firm. Okay, now, we don't talk about Littlejohn Financial a lot on this program.
We really don't.
That's okay. This is more intended as education, entertainment, and sort of a resource to get the wheels turning, get the creativity turning around finance, and just to give you a chance to maybe explore some other ideas and learn a little bit. Well, our firm, we do manage investment assets for customers, right? So we've got everything from retirement plans to we've got some endowment type funds, and we have our own methodology that we utilize. And so it's a sort of a semi-active and tactical approach to investing. It's not indexing. It's not a hands-off approach. We're fairly engaged with what we do. And so we have regular committee meetings where we get together, we're looking at a lot of different data points, and then making decisions about the market. And I can tell you, and let me just preface this by saying this, don't construe what I'm about to share with you as investment advice or a recommendation. Okay, that's not what I'm about to do. But I'm going to tell you some insight into what our committee was discussing recently. And for the past 2 or 3 years, we have been very sour on the bond market. Right? I mean, just sour on it. It's not that we would completely refuse to engage in it. We did have some fixed income holdings that were really short duration. They were sort of like alternatives to money market.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just really, because there's, I will use the phrase, not much meat on the bone, right? And what I mean is not worth doing for the amount of risk that you're taking for the returns that you get. Like it was a big pile of who cares. I could leave the money in a bank and pretty much have about the same result without having my principal fluctuate much.
Right.
So bonds didn't make a lot of academic sense to us for quite some time. So we did other things to create bond-like behavior in our investment strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And we used some derivatives, some alternative asset classes. We did a lot of correlation study and making sure we were owning things that sort of behaved cooperatively with each other. So you have to, like, you know, position A and position B, and they don't run in the same direction at the same time. Right. It doesn't mean they're
beta.
Inverse to each other. Like one goes up, the other goes down. We weren't trying to hedge. We were trying to make them very, very independent of each other so that if one was moving, it wasn't influencing the other. So we spent a lot of academic time working on getting that to a spot where we were trying to insulate and reduce risk using sort of, we'll call them investment structuring techniques.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And this morning we looked at the, you know, 30-year bonds, 30-year mortgages,
right,
up now close to 7%, and we're starting to look at the yield curve on bonds and going, you know, the interest rates that you're starting to see, the yield in the bond market is starting to look more investable.
Mm-hmm.
Why? And, you know, it's the Fed's allowing rates to rise. So if rates go up, if you don't recall this.
It's that teeter-totter effect.
Yeah. Bonds are a teeter-totter, right? So what happens, Matt? If rates go up.
Then bond prices go down.
Yeah. Now, bond prices, the longer it takes for your bond to mature. Because remember, a bond is a loan.
Right.
And you're loaning it for a period of time,
right?
They're
selling at a discount if the interest rates go up.
And so, like, if you loan the money out for 10 years and interest rates change, and you got 10 years before you're going to get paid back, and you needed to sell that bond to somebody else, it's going to be pretty interest rate sensitive potentially because you're like, well, shoot, the rates changed. If the rates go up, nobody wants to buy my bond at full price anymore because they had to wait 10 years to get their principal back.
Right.
So your bond price would be discounted. Now, if your bond's going to mature in a week, it's not going to be that interest rate sensitive because, you know, in 10 days or whatever, I get my money back.
Right.
So we care about the duration or interest rate sensitivity of bonds. And with interest rates on the rise, on purpose, Federal Reserve setting policy and the Federal Reserve not buying anymore, which means there's nobody willing to overpay for the bonds. The people left buying bonds don't want to spend as much because they don't want to tie their money up long term for no return.
Mm-hmm.
So the rates go down. Or I'm sorry, the rates go up and the price of the bond falls.
Yep.
And now we're talking at committee level saying, hey, at what point do we start dipping our toe in the water of the fixed income marketplace? Right? I mean, how many of our listeners, if you think back, do you guys remember like late 70s, early 80s and treasury bonds, like 30-year bonds paying 18%?
That's wild.
Imagine if you could lock in 18% returns on fixed income accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if inflation was running at 25%, you'd still be losing money.
And it begs the question, what is inflation really running at?
I know. And it's
because they can tell us whatever they want, but is that accurate to...
Well, and it depends. You know, I don't even know that they are hiding the data.
Right.
I think what they've done is they've decided, well, we're going to report it in this way,
mm-hmm.
which is different than we used to report it. And so you have to go
change the calculation
for the different data points to get a more composite view of inflation. I can tell you, inflation in some areas of the economy is running close to 20%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, outrageous inflation rates.
Right.
I saw not a very fun article about Roseburg specifically, where we live. And if you're listening to this, we do have listeners across the country and across the globe now.
Yep.
If you're listening to this and you're thinking, so our market had sort of the dubious distinction, our domestic real estate market, of showing up on, it was like a Yahoo Finance article or something.
Okay.
But it basically falls in the top 10 for markets that are appreciating at such a rate that they're going to become uninvestable for the people that live there, right? Wow. The properties get so expensive that the job market won't allow a person living in that community to afford to live there.
So an influx of money from other areas that can afford it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my theory is that, and this is not to bash on people that are moving to town, but as an example, well, here, I'll give you, all right, we got to take a break because we're at that time, right?
Ah.
So when we come back, I want to give you the example of like, what is driving real estate prices? At least my theory. Mm. And then you'll be like, oh, yeah. And then we'll grumble and then we'll talk about, well, how might we, you know, fix it? But we got to take a break. So stick around. We'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. On News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
There's the more music. Cool. Ooh. All right, hey, we're back.
We got sound effects.
I know, right? So welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
Yep. And we are...
We were talking about Californians, right?
You're going to talk about California, I guess. We're talking about how... Roseburg is on a list. So Yahoo Finance article that showed up, and the list was basically what are communities that in the next 10 years houses aren't going to be affordable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Roseburg's on the list, right?
That's pretty impressive.
And
we
in fact, it was like one or two on the list. I'm just going to Google this real quick. Watch this. So Let's see, like communities. What should you call it? Where
I really hope you can hear the key.
Spell it right. Yeah. Aren't affordable in 10 years.
This is actually happening. Googling
right,
it
right
in studio.
Here.
The keys are going.
And now I don't see the...
that's
a
letdown.
It was a Yahoo article. I know, what a letdown. But because a buddy of mine sent it. But anyway, what city has the least affordable housing? China. San Jose, California is number 4 on the list, though.
Really?
So, but we made the list of communities that are pricing everybody out. And I wanted to talk about why. Right? Mm-hmm. Like why would that happen? And then what might we be able to do? And it's going to be a tricky one.
Okay.
But we can play this game, right? We're all friends here. So first of all, I'm not picking on people that move to this community, right? Think about why. It's because this community is really attractive to a certain type
it's
of
awesome.
Person.
Right? Look at the weather. I mean, the area's got multiple rivers. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. So here's the thing. When considering... The housing market, Oregon has some, fairly aggressive land use restrictions.
Okay.
And so different areas of the state, the land is zoned for specific things. So you can only do certain things with the land based on the zoning.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a permitting process and a bunch of other elements. So what it does is it makes it more expensive and more difficult to build homes, residential property in many areas. And so you end up with a scenario where you restrict the supply of available housing because of these. This is an example when people say, oh, you know, regulations make things cost more. It's like, well, it does. Like if you have a reduction in the supply of available land to build homes on, and then you have bottlenecks where price and availability also affect the ability to get permitting to do things, then it will mean fewer houses are able to be built, and it will cost more to build them.
Right. Can you imagine if there weren't any? Like, just build a house wherever you want. You own the land. Do what you want with it.
And there's a lot more flexibility in some regions of the country than
others. Texas,
yeah.
For example.
There's a lot fewer land use restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not arguing whether that's good, bad, or otherwise, but I am telling you that it contributes to some significant factors where you can't just say, well, we need more affordable housing, plunk them down, right? Because the process of doing it is expensive, right? And the raw materials right now are expensive. So just do the basic math on this. If an affordable home can be built, and I'm going to say this is below market. Like, I don't even think you can do this. But for $150 a square foot, and you build a 1,000 square foot place, that's $150,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't bought any dirt yet, right? So find me a place where you can plunk a $150,000 house down. It's probably $50,000 worth of dirt, too.
Now we're
so
at two.
You're at least $200,000 for a 1,000 square foot, like 2-bedroom, 1-bath, or maybe a 3-bedroom, 1-bath place, and you're like crammed into it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you do a more typical, say, 1,500 square foot, 3-bedroom, 2-bath, this is a small house too on a very small parcel. You're still talking about now not 1,000 square feet for 150, but you've added 50% to the price. So it's a $225,000.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the land of 50, you're at $275,000. What part of that is affordable, especially at 6.87% rate?
Right.
So what happens is we have a limited supply. It's very expensive to build. And there's no incentive for builders to build low-end homes because there's no margin in it. Like at $150 a square foot, they basically break even. So build for $200 a square foot so that you can make some profits as the builder.
Mm-hmm.
And but now you've taken the house and you've increased it by another 35%, right? So it's not $275 anymore. You're going to tack on another almost $100,000. So it's like $360 or so. Okay. We're off the pattern of affordable already, and it's because the builders need to be able to do this at a profit as well.
Mm-hmm.
And now you still have scarcity and people competing for those homes, and somebody with a $1 million home in California says, I'm out of here, I want to be done. They sell their $1 million house and they move up here and they say, I have to compete for this home. It's $360,000, but I'm going to bid $400,000 for it so I can make sure and get it.
Yep.
And now all the comps in the area are at $400,000. And it's even more unaffordable. So now the person that moved up here from California or wherever that had this expensive home, they still have $600,000 in their pocket, assuming that their taxes and other elements mm-hmm. are kind of a push, which they wouldn't be completely. But so let's say they got $500,000 in their pocket. They have their house paid for free and clear. They have $5,000 in their pocket. And now through Social Security, retirement plans, and basic pensions, they can afford to live here.
Yep.
But all the people that need to provide the services and work here, unless you're at a very, like, now you go, okay, well, our surgeons and physicians and folks that can make 6 figures a year, they can afford to go buy a house because of the money that they earn.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the people that are in our service community that are making $15 an hour?
Yeah, where
right?
are they
$15
gonna,
an hour,
gonna
so now minimum wage, it's like, it just can't be affordable.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be. And so everybody goes, well, then you better raise the minimum wage. Okay, well, that doesn't fix it because it changes the input cost to everything else. It's the same thing that makes houses cost more.
Yep.
Cost more to build them because it costs more for the labor in them too. Well, that doesn't fix it. So how do you fix the challenge of folks coming in and bidding things way up? And there's only a handful of levers to pull left, right? You can try to increase the supply of available housing. Okay.
Changing the regulations.
You can change the regulations or the land use.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that are probably pounding the desk right now saying, well, if we didn't have the same restrictions on, for example, harvesting timber on federal lands,
yeah,
then that would certainly give us the ability to lower the cost of lumber because mm-hmm. the supply would change. Now, whether that's good or not, I mean, timber companies may say, well, you know, I kind of like the margins right now, right? Because the reality is it's not always like this.
It's
and
true.
I will tell you, it won't always be like this. We are watching the markets change sort of a slow motion train crash right now.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how long it takes, but, you know, we're going to reach unsustainability quick because personal incomes can't keep up with the cost of living right now. And businesses can't just keep marking everything up to infinity. There is an uncle point at which it breaks and we go into recession. And then that demand destruction that everybody loves that high demand for business right now, but demand destruction when people just stop buying houses because we give up, we're just going to all, because here's another solution, right? People just start bunking up, right? Get mm-hmm. roommates, more people, higher density. This has happened in many countries throughout history where families start sharing homes because there's economies of scale. It's a cultural shift, but it's not beyond possible in this country.
Oh, right? I think we're starting to see it a little bit. Yeah.
Yep. Could just become a reality. More people start
converting the garage.
Yep. Yep. So that's another. So change the supply. You can change the culture. You can also change the industry, right? Invite money from out of area that doesn't have to live here. Okay, this is tourism or other industry that's an exporter, right? You know who does this great?
Who?
China.
Ah.
Right? I mean, hey, go ahead, send us your raw materials. We'll send you back the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you can buy the stuff from us. And they get more money from us than we get from them. It's a trade imbalance, right?
100%.
So Roseburg could work on that. Now, that doesn't solve our problem nationally. It just solves the local problem as well and change the inflow outflow so that people locally, there are more high-paying jobs that give people the ability to afford things. Now, it doesn't fix the service industry. This is the Hamptons problem, by the way.
Okay.
Right? The Hamptons problem is years ago, houses in the Hamptons got so expensive that the people that worked there, like in the service industry,
mm-hmm.
you know, the whether it's housekeeping or, you know, restaurants and waiters and waitresses and chefs and all that, they couldn't afford to live in the Hamptons.
Right.
Right. So they were commuting 2-3 hours from somewhere else to work in the Hamptons.
So they're just going to have to get compensated.
It raises the cost of everything. But there's a natural process to that too, right? If you raise the price enough, it stops being attractive to people, and then they leave, and then the demand drops, and then the demand destruction creates local recession. And it, you know, you can have boom and bust in our country. If you don't believe me, go look at Detroit, right? Mm. I mean, there's a recessionary environment when you go look at like the Bay Area or Silicon Valley, and it exploded,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because one industry was rising while another one was falling.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, there are some things that can augment, but it still doesn't fix our service industry gap.
Hmm.
Now, there's probably another thing we could do. It's my least favorite thing.
Wow. That's a pretty bold statement.
The least favorite thing we could do. You know what it is?
Take a break?
Yep. I'll tell you after the okay. break. Stick around and we'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM at 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. Welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
And if you're just getting caught up, here's the story. It's going to be on podcast. Check it out tomorrow on our webpage at littlejohnfs.com under the Educate tab. And you can get hooked up and listen to these until your heart is content. They go way back in time. I don't even know if they got better or not, though.
Hmm.
But I do know this, okay? We were talking about the break, and there's one other solution to when housing prices get all wacky and out of control, and it's my least favorite solution. So it means I don't really know that it's a solution.
It changes things.
Well, yeah, what it is manipulation,
mm-hmm.
and that just creates other problems. And I'm just going to say it, right? Like, you can't
what type of
cheat a market. Well, you can supplement or subsidize.
Ooh.
Right? This is things like when government installs affordable housing,
mm-hmm.
okay? Which is effectively saying, well, if you don't earn enough money, you can live here so that you can then, in the Hamptons, right? So you can afford to live here and do the jobs that support all of the other people that make lots of money. And my impression of that is it sort of creates a caste system. Never liked it that much. And, you know, the other thing that you could do is if you want to bring down the cost of housing in general, you could create some kind of subsidies for some of the costs to get a home started. You could do that through tax incentives, mm-hmm. ownership incentives, and other things. And you could make those somewhat of a sliding scale. Now, this is a more progressive idea. It's not one that I, as a more traditional conservative capitalist, would buy into, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that traditional capitalism is what is generating the imbalance of this market, like the local market here in Roseburg. People want to come here. They have money. They're willing to spend it. And so they vote with their dollars, and here they come.
Yep.
And then The question is, can it stay affordable to live here? Right? And maybe the answer is no. But it creates, you know, there's other issues that it creates, other structural issues with, and if you're listening and going, wow, you said structural issue, what the heck? I'm not talking about like, you know, like bridges and or a house framing or something. And oh, there's a, when I say structural issues, I mean, it creates a problem where one financial thing connects to another financial thing. And when you have a problem in one area, it makes the other areas have problems too, because they're connected. So structural unemployment, like there's just not enough jobs and we have more people than jobs. Okay, well, it's a structural problem. You can't just employ everybody because there's more people than jobs.
Right.
Structural problem, right? So it's just a sort of a way to say that. And so I worry that that's kind of the direction that we're headed right now, is that the incentive is we, because of land use restrictions and so forth, we can't natively just let the supply and demand float to fix the cost of housing, right? If we could just build more houses without the restrictions, then in theory we could say, okay, well then we'll just build until supply meets demand and the prices will start to drop again because there's supply demand balance. But if we keep having the government put their finger on the scale through land use restriction, then somebody else is going to argue again, which I don't agree with, but they'll say, well, then we need to put the thumb on the scale somewhere else through incentives or some kind of rebates to make it affordable for other groups. I'm like, so two wrongs don't make right. It just means there's more unnatural markets taking place. And I don't know that that really fixes it. It just means that it creates other imbalances for people to exploit, and then the government tries to go in and fix the new one. Like, well, like keeping dough stuffed in a tube that's too small, right? You squish harder here and it spits out somewhere else. Like, it's just not going to all fit in there. So,
yep. Kind of like a dog chasing its tail.
Yeah. So you have to let the markets address the issue. If you artificially go in there and mess with it, for a season, you might be able to fix it. And maybe it even works temporarily. Right. Maybe you can say, well, if we temporarily intervene because we have a population lobe that's going to go away. Right. You know, we have a big demographic push, but there's nothing behind to fill in the gap. You're like, so for a little while, we're going to supplement because we know there's going to be a dip that follows. OK, now we're getting into more Keynesian style economic thinking about, like, you know, during the peaks, you bank the surplus, during the troughs, you spend it, try to balance it out, and government can, you know, put a finger on the scale to do that. But again, when possible, my preference is the freest markets you can manage without harming others or creating monopolies or oligopolies, right? So I want natural competition and lots of it to manage price. The freer the market is, the happier I tend to be, recognizing that free-ish markets are about as close as we're going to get. Unnatural capitalism can also be its own challenge because not everybody's a good actor, right? Not everybody's an ethical capitalist.
That's true.
Right? Some people will exploit. And I'm like, well, what do we do with you if you're exploitative? Like, we got an issue. And so, and for all of my listeners out there that are saying, well, yeah, no kidding, people will take advantage. I go, you're right. I'm not naive to that. So we have to have regulations to keep people from abusing it.
Mm-hmm.
If I could trust everybody to be more altruistic and, you know, maybe we wouldn't have that same conversation. But you know what the world's taught me?
Don't trust anyone.
trust but verify, right? Trust but verify. And it is what it is. So anyway, there you go, right? I mean, rising interest rates, it will affect the housing market. It will change dynamics. I mean, locally, I think it will start to affect here, but that supply-demand imbalance is still pretty strained. I mean, how creative will you be to go get into a house if you want to?
Well, yeah, you're going to have to pull some strings. Like, yeah.
And, you know, I got buddies in the lending industry. I'm sure they're just like, oh, man, all of a sudden life got a lot more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, it was refi.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the new home purchases, prices are high. But I got to believe that on the fringes and on the upper end of the marketplace, like, you're going to start to see some pressure.
Yeah.
You know, I remember probably 4 or 5 years ago, you could count the number of seven-figure homes that sold in this county on your fingers in
right.
a year.
And now there are
and you can't right now. There's more. There's a lot more high-dollar transactions. Some of that's because of the inflation we've seen, and you know, the money printing and the COVID loans and PPP and just money everywhere.
Yeah.
Right. But some of it is also because interest rates were so low that you really could access a lot more money to chase after goods. And as that changes, I expect the economy to change too.
Yeah.
So what does it mean in the future? Well, lots of stuff, but it means that bonds may not be out of vogue forever. Right.
And yeah.
So I think that's the interesting one. So
the marketplace could be changing.
Yeah. Interest rates. And it also means for our stock investors out there, you may be in for a little more of a roller coaster, right?
Mm-hmm.
Long-term inflation, the markets tend to adjust for inflation, right? Historically, the equity market has responded well and exceeded inflation, historically. But it hasn't been without a wild ride.
Absolutely.
And so I'm just telling, and if you get into the real nuts and bolts of it, right? If you were an analyst and you were looking at your formulas, one of the things you would say is, you know what? The cost of risk is changing, right? The cost to borrow money is going up because the risk of default is going up. That's a cost of risk calculation.
That's true.
It's going to change equities just like it's changing in bonds. So it will make its way into the system, and that's part of why we're seeing more volatility. So hang on.
Put on your seatbelts.
That is the music. It is time. How time flies. Matt, if they want to get more information, how can they reach us?
They should give us a call, 541-375-0898, or then go to the website. Check us out. Listen to the podcast at littlejohnfs.com.
All right, gang. So that's it. You heard it here first, but it won't be last. Thanks for tuning in. As always, this has been David Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
The preceding program was paid for by Littlejohn Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.